This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Rest of Us Just Live Here by Patrick Ness. Read for you by James Foley. Chapter the First, in which the messenger of the immortals arrives in a surprising shape, looking for a permanent vessel, and after being chased by her through the woods, Indy Kid Finn meets his final fate. B. On the day we're the last people to see Indy Kid Finn alive, we're all sprawled together in the field, talking about love and stomachs. I don't believe that, though, my sister says, and I look up at the slight tension in her voice. She gives me a half-annoyed nod of reassurance in the sunshine, then shakes her head again at Hannah. You always have a choice. I don't care if you think it's love. And by the way, not a word you should throw around so easily. But even if that word, you can still choose to act right. I said I loved the way he looked, Hannah says. I didn't say I loved him. You're twisting my words. And that's not what I'm talking about anyway. I'm talking about how your heart fills up. Actually, no, it's not even your heart. It's your stomach. You feel it, and everything just goes. No, it doesn't, my sister says firmly. No, it doesn't. Mel, you can feel it, and you can still do the right thing. Hannah frowns. Why is it a question of the right thing? I'm describing a totally normal human feeling. Nathan's a hot guy. I look back down at my history textbook. I touch each of the four corners, counting silently to myself. I see Jared notice. You said you had no choice, Mel pursues. You said if you'd been able to kiss him, you would have done it right there, regardless of who saw. Or if he had a girlfriend already. Or if Tony was around. I'm not going out with Tony anymore. Yeah, but you know how sensitive he is. You'd have hurt him. And then you'd have said you had no choice and it would have been bullshit. Hannah puts her hands over her face in frustration. Melinda, it's something I feel strongly about. I can see that. And don't call me Melinda.
Hannah's right, though,
Jared says, from where he's lying back with his head on Hannah's butt.
It is in your stomach.
On a guy, you'd think it'd be lower, Mel says.
That's different,
Jared says, sitting up.
Your dick or whatever, that's just wanting. Animal stuff. This is more.
Yeah,
Hannah agrees. You feel it right here.
Jared puts his hand on his belly. It's a biggish kind of belly, and we know he doesn't draw attention to it lightly.
And it's like, for that moment, everything you believed is wrong, or doesn't matter. And everything that was complicated is suddenly, like, yes and no simple. Because your stomach is really the boss, and it's telling you that your desire is possible, and that it's not the answer to everything, but it's the one thing that's going to make the questions more bearable.
He stops, looking up into the sun. We all know what he means. He knows we all know what he means. He never really talks about it, though. We wish he did. Your stomach isn't the boss of you, Mel says evenly.
Oh,
Jared says, realizing.
Sorry.
Mel shakes her head, brushing it off. Not what I meant. Your heart isn't the boss of you either. Thinks it is. Isn't. You can always choose. Always. You can't choose not to feel, Hannah says. But you can choose how to act.
Yeah, Jared says. Hard, though. Early Christians thought your soul was in your stomach, I say.
There's a silence as a new wind blows across the grass, all by its lonesome, as if saying, don't mind me.
Dad told me once, I say.
Mel looks down to her laptop and starts typing in more homework answers. "And what would Dad know, I wonder?" she says. The wind picks up a little more. "Terribly sorry," I imagine it saying. Apparently the wind is British, wondering how it got all the way over here. And Hannah has to snap her hand down on a page of an assignment that's threatening to fly away. "Why do we even have paper anymore?"
"Books," Jared says.
"Toilet paper?" Mel says.
"Because paper is a thing," I say. "And sometimes you need things rather than just thoughts."
"I wasn't really looking for an answer," Hannah says, tucking the page, a handout on the Civil War that we've all got, under her computer tablet. I tap the four corners of my textbook again, counting silently in my head. And again. And one more time. I see Jared watching me, but pretending not to. Another gust of British wind tousles my hair. "Top of the morning!" Oh, no wait, that's Irish. It's a sunny day for it to be so windy all of a sudden. We only come out here when the weather's nice enough, and it's been a weirdly warm April and early May. The field isn't really much of a field. It's more like a property plot that someone never built on because they died or lost it in a divorce or something. A big grassy square at the end of the road from my house with some handy sawn-off tree stumps scattered here and there. Rows of trees block it off from the rest of everything else, too. You'd have to make a point of coming back here to know about it, which nobody does as we're so far out in the boonies. It's only actual super-thick forest beyond anyway. You can hear coyotes at night, and we get deer in our yard all the time.
"Hey," Jared says. "Anyone doing the reconstruction after the Civil War essay, or is it just me?"
"I am," I say.
"You are?"
Mel says, distressed.
"I'm doing it too."
"Me too," Hannah says.
"Everyone?" Jared says.
Mel looks at me.
"Could you not? I mean, could you really, really not?"
"I've got all these notes, though," I say.
"But I'm really good on the reconstruction."
"So do the reconstruction essay."
"We can't both do it. Yours will be all brainiac, and I'll look stupid by comparison."
My sister always does this. She thinks she's stupid. She's so, so not.
"It'll be better than mine," Jared says.
"Mikey, just let me do it."
And here, I know, most people would be thinking, "Bossy older sister." And most people who don't know us would be wondering why we're both seniors, even though she's more than a year older than me. And most people would think they could hear a spoiled tone in her voice. Most people would be wrong. She's not whining. She's asking kinda nicely for her. And most people wouldn't see the fear in her eyes over this exam. But I can.
"Okay,"
I say. "I'll do causes of the Civil War." She nods her head and thanks. She turns to Hannah.
"Could you do causes too?"
"Hey,"
Jared says.
"What about me?"
"Seriously?" Mel says to him.
"Nah, not seriously."
He laughs. Jared, despite being big and tall and shaving by age 11 and a linebacker on the football team since we were all freshmen, is a math guy. Give him numbers, he's great. Give him words and sentences to put together, and his forehead creases down so you can see exactly what he'll look like when he's 80.
"Mel," Hannah says, "you gotta stop."
Which is when one of the indie kids comes running out of the tree line, his old-timey jacket flapping out behind him. He pushes his fashionably black-rimmed glasses back on his nose and runs past about 20 feet from where we're all tumbled together. He doesn't see us. The indie kids never really see us, not even when we're sitting next to them in class. Just crosses the field and disappears into the opposite tree line, which we all know only leads to deeper forest. There's a silent few seconds where we all exchange WTF glances, and then a young girl glowing with her own light comes running out of the woods from where the indie kid came. She doesn't see us either, though she's so bright we all have to shade our eyes, and then she disappears into the second tree line too. None of us says anything for a minute. Then Jared asks,
"Was that Finn?"
"Which Finn?"
my sister says.
Aren't all the indie kids called Finn?
I think there are a couple Dylans, Hannah says, and a Nash.
There are two Satchels, I know that, I say. A boy satchel and a girl satchel.
It was one of the Finns, Jared says. I'm pretty sure.
A pillar of blue light, bright enough to see even in the sunshine, shoots up suddenly from a point where the indie kid, I think Jared's right, it was one of the ones called Finn, and the glowing girl might have run.
What are they doing now? Mel says. What was with the little girl?
And the lights, I say. They better not blow up the high school again, Jared says. My cousin had to have his graduation ceremony in a parking lot.
Do you think Nathan is an indie kid?
Hannah asks, making Mel groan.
The name could go either way, Jared says, watching the pillar glow.
What kind of a guy transfers to a new school 5 weeks before the end of his senior year? I ask, trying not to make it sound like anything, tapping the corners of my textbook again.
The kind of guy that Hannah falls in love with, Mel says.
Oh my God, I didn't say love, Hannah shouts.
Mel grins.
You sure seem to have a lot of passion about the subject, though, or is that just your stomach talking?
The wind stops all of a sudden.
Light's gone, Jared says.
The pillar of light has faded. We can't hear the sound of anyone running anymore. We watch the woods, not sure what to expect.
Then we all jump when my sister's laptop starts playing a song we like. It's an alarm, she said. It means our parents have left our house for the evening to go visit our grandmother. It means it's safe to go home.
Chapter the Second, in which Indie Kid Satchel writes a poem, and her mom and dad give her loving space to just feel what she needs to. Then an indie kid called Dylan arrives at her house, terrified, to say a mysterious glowing girl has informed him of the death of Indie Kid Finn. Satchel and Dylan comfort each other, platonically. B. Over the course of my life, I've told Hannah about my mad, desperate feelings for her exactly zero times. We've got a lot in common. A thing with anxiety we don't really like to talk about, best friends who we kind of love more than any girlfriend or boyfriend could really compete with, parents who aren't the best. We've got Mel in common, of course, so that's good. And we're also both not indie kids, even though she's totally got an indie kid name. But it's because her dad is foreign, so it doesn't count. And I guess in Finland, Hannah isn't very indie kid anyway. Plus, her last name is impossible. We've been friends since we were 8, over half my life now, though mostly with my sister as an intermediary. I've been madly, desperately in love with Hannah from when we were about 12. She started dating Tony Kim slightly before then, which was, of course, the thing that made me realize the madly, desperately thing. She broke up with Tony this past New Year and has been single since then. It's now May. So, what have I been doing for the last 5 months? I refer you to zero times above.
Coast is clear,
Mel says as the four of us come down our driveway, dogs barking eternally in distant yards, and see my mom's car gone. We live in a suburb of a suburb of a suburb of a suburb of a city that takes about an hour to get to. There's nothing out here but woods and the huge great mountain on the very near horizon that'll blow up one day and flatten everyone and everything in this part of the state. That could happen tomorrow. It could happen 5,000 years from now. Life, huh? The road to our house only got properly paved last year, and our neighbors are a mixture of professionals like my parents who wanted a bit of land to build a house on, and other people who think Fox News is too liberal and build bunkers for their guns. Out here, people either grow organic turnips or vast fields of marijuana. My parents do daffodils. Don't walk on them. I mean, seriously, don't walk on them. Hannah's parents live down the road, but that's coincidence because we actually know them from the church both our families have gone to for 100 years. Hannah's mom is the music minister there. She and Hannah are the only black people in the whole church.
that's our tiny bit of the world for you. Henna's dad is a white Finnish foot doctor, so, like, really white, who does mission trips to Africa with Henna's mom. That's where Henna is going to spend this summer, the last summer she could spend with her high school friends before leaving for a very Christian college. She's going to be in the Central African Republic speaking high school French to Central African Republicans who are going to get foot doctoring and music ministry whether they want to or not. What this means is that 5 months of a last chance since her breakup with Tony has narrowed down to 4.5 weeks of a last chance until graduation. Given my success rate to date, I don't think my odds are very good. Mel lets us in the house, and we aren't 2 steps inside before Mary Magdalene, our tubby little orange cat, is running a purring streak around Jared's legs. He touches her nose lightly with his finger. "I see you," he whispers, and Mary Mags does an ecstatic, lopsided spin to the floor like a falling propeller. "Anyone want anything?" Mel says, heading to the kitchen. Jared asks for an energy drink. Henna asks for an energy drink. I ask for an energy drink. "Little help?" Mel calls from the kitchen. I go over. I look at the glass of water she's poured herself. "I'm fine," she says quietly. "We are out of Diet Coke, and I hate the taste of those things." She's got a point about the energy drinks, which are all called Monstro Pop or Rev or Lotus Sexy, and which are, yeah, kind of disgusting, but so filled with caffeine, I'm unlikely to sleep until college. We're next to the fridge. I open the door. There's a bottle of Diet Coke in the back. It only has a little bit in it, but still. "Mikey," she whispers. I look into her eyes. "Sometimes it's just hard," she says. "It doesn't mean anything, and you saw me at lunch." I did see her at lunch, and she's right, it was fine. Home is always harder for her. I tap the rims of each of the 4 glasses in turn with my fingers. I tap them again. "Damn it," I whisper, and tap them again. Mel just waits. 3 times seems to be enough, so I shut the fridge door and help her take the drinks out to the couches.
"What do you think that was in the field?" asks Henna, looking worried. "With the indie kid?"
"I hope nothing," Mel says. "And even if it is something, they'd better hold off until after graduation."
"I just mean I hope he's okay," Henna says. And we all can tell she's thinking of her brother.
"The indie kids, huh? You've got them at your school, too. That group with the cool geek haircuts and the thrift shop clothes and names from the 50s. Nice enough, never mean, but always the ones who end up being the chosen one when the vampires come calling, or when the alien queen needs the source of all light or something. They're too cool to ever, ever do anything like go to prom or listen to music other than jazz while reading poetry. They've always got some story going on that they're heroes of. The rest of us just have to live here, hovering around the edges, left out of it all for the most part." Having said that, the indie kids do die a lot, which must suck.
"Where's Meredith?" Jared asks, changing the subject.
"Our little sister, Meredith, and, yes, I know, Michael and Melinda and Meredith and even Mary Magdalene the cat. We once even had a Labrador called Martha, but she bit a porcupine one day, and that was the end of that. Apparently, you can put a price on love. It's slightly less than $1,200 for doggy face surgery. Anyway, Meredith is 10, a loon, maybe a genius, our mom is certainly counting on it, and is hopelessly, painfully ensnared by Bolts of Fire, the country and western boy band specifically created to hopelessly and painfully ensnare 10-year-old girls, even the geniuses. She's played their biggest song, Bold Sapphire, by Bolts of Fire, get it? Exactly 1,157 times. I know because I checked after begging my parents for mercy from having to hear it a 1,158th. We are all a little obsessive, us Mitchell kids.
Jared is a firm second in her affections after Bolts of Fire, though. He's big, he's friendly, and there's the whole cat deal. If there's one thing we all, every one of us agree on, it's that Jared is going to be a great dad. Not that any of us have first-hand experience of one, really. Except Jared, which figures. German lessons, I tell him. My mom didn't think she was being challenged enough at school. Jared blinks. She's 10. They're still hoping they've got one left who isn't screwed up. Mel says, flicking on a downloaded TV program we've all already seen as background noise. Hannah looks at me. You're not screwed up. No one in this family is screwed up, says our mother, coming through the front door. That's the official campaign line, and we're sticking to it. She drops her purse on the table by the door, already frowning at the four teenagers draped across her couches. She's 2 hours early. Hello, everyone, she practically booms, seeming friendly enough, though Mel and I can already tell we're going to pay for this later. Look at all the feet up on the furniture. Jared and Hannah slowly put their feet on the floor. Hello, State Senator, Jared says politely. Just Senator is the protocol, Jared, my mom says with a tight smile. Even for a lowly state government official, as I'm sure you must know by now. Hello, Hannah. Mrs. Mitchell. Hannah greets, her voice 3 sizes smaller than a minute ago. You're early, Mel says. Yes, my mom says. I can see how you might think that. Where's Dad? I ask. Still with your grandma. How is she? Mom's smile gets even tighter. You two staying for dinner? She asks Jared and Hannah, somehow communicating clearly that they're not actually invited. No, thank you, Jared says, getting up, downing his energy drink in one gulp. We were just heading out. You don't have to leave on my account, my mom says, meaning that, yes, yes, they do. Homework, Hannah says, gathering her things quickly. She leaves her energy drink on the coffee table. It's already sweating beads of water down the side, and I can feel my heart start to race at the need to either put a coaster underneath it or wipe the water away or something. One glass of energy drink. One. Mel sees me staring at the glass, picks it up off the table and drinks it down, even though she particularly hates Lotus Sexy. I give her a pleading look of thanks. While I've been trapped, Jared and Hannah are at the door already, waving their goodbyes. The door shuts behind them. It's just us family now. Embrace the warmth. It's bad enough you're friends with that boy, my mom starts. I get up so fast, she stops mid-sentence. I don't put on my jacket. I don't take anything with me except the car keys I've already got in my pocket. I'm out the door before she can do anything more than give me a shocked look. I catch Jared and Hannah out on the walk. Ride home? I say. It takes about 3 seconds to drop Hannah off down the street, though I do get a full eye contact thank you from her as she gets out. My mad, desperate head thinks of mad, desperate things to say to her, but of course I don't. Then Jared and I are driving, even though his own car is still parked at my house. I turn the opposite direction from where he lives. He says nothing. We drive until the sun sets. There are more back roads into and out of these woods than anyone can count, than are probably on any map. You can drive and drive and drive and just see forest and fields, the occasional cow, the occasional elk, the even more occasional moose, the animal patron saint of perpetual embarrassment. I can relate, though not to being Catholic, which I've apparently decided mooses are. The mountain glows in and out of view, turning pink, then blue, then shadow, as it watches us wander. I finally stop in a turnoff by a glacial lake, huge, crystal clear, cold as death. Is it Hannah? Jared finally asks. It's not Hannah,
I say into the dark. Well, it is, but not just that, and not my parents either.
Good, because I'm fine about that. The bad feeling between me and your mom is entirely mutual.
I stare out into the really amazingly dark night. There are more stars over my part of the world than anywhere else I've ever seen.
4.5 weeks to go.
4.5 weeks,
Jared agrees.
Graduation.
He waits. I wait too. After a long minute, I turn on the cabin light and hold up my hands to him.
What am I looking at?
He asks. I point to my fingertips. They are wrinkled and cracked. Eczema.
And?
I turn off the cabin light. I washed my hands 17 times this morning after taking a piss before history. Jared exhales a long, long time. Dude. I just swallow. It's loud in the silence. I think it's starting again.
It's probably just the pressure of everything, Jared offers. Finals, your massively unrequited love for Henna.
Don't say unrequited.
Your massively invisible love for Henna.
I hit him on the arm. It's friendly. More silence. What if I go crazy? I finally whisper. I feel Jared shrug.
At least it'll piss off the senator.
We laugh. A little.
You won't, Mikey, he says. And if you do, I'll be there to pull you back.
Which makes me feel... Okay, look. Jared likes guys. We all know it. He's told us, even though he's never officially had a boyfriend, because who the hell is he going to meet out here who isn't a creepy old farmer? And he never really talks about it, or what he gets up to on those weekend evenings when we know he's not working, but still says he can't come out with us. And fine. He and I have messed around a few times growing up together, even though I like girls. Even though I like Henna. Because a horny teenage boy would do it with a tree trunk if it offered at the right moment. But you're going to have to hear this the right way when I tell you that I love exactly 3 people in the entire world, excluding whatever this is with Henna. 3 people. Mel, Meredith, and the 3rd person isn't either of my parents.
You want to talk crazy?
Jared says. Yeah, I say. Yeah, I know. There's so much crazy in this world. My counting and hand-washing and door-locking and checking and tapping can seem like raging mental health by comparison. Jared's crazy is way crazier than mine, though I don't think his makes him lie awake at night in bed thinking it'd be easier if he was... You know. And if you don't know, you don't want to.
There's a mountain lion out there,
Jared says, looking out his window. I sigh. There's always a mountain lion out there.
Chapter 3rd, in which Indie Kid Finn's body is discovered. Satchel, who once dated Finn, asks Dylan and a 2nd Indie Kid, also called Finn, to skip school and help her talk to her alcoholic uncle, who is the lead police officer investigating the death. Meanwhile, the messenger, inside a new vessel, is already among them, preparing the way for the arrival of the immortals.
B. Our town is just like your town. Schools, family-themed restaurants, lots of cars. There's a bunch of huge churches clustered together, trying to blend in with all the family-themed restaurants, because salvation is as easy as chicken wings, I guess. We've got fire stations with signs that tell you when burning season begins and ends. We've got sheriff's offices with signs that tell you to buckle up. We've got a lumberyard with signs that tell you angry right-wing puns. We've got RV lots, banks, a Walmart, a couple multiplexes. We've got trees. So many trees. Everything here used to be a forest, after all. And yeah, so fine. Our part of town has more than its fair share of trees and less than its fair share of multiplexes, but don't look down on us. It was just as bad here as it was for you when the indie kids were battling the undead in our neck of the woods, though that was just after I was born, so I only know about it from my Uncle Rick. who doesn't get invited around very much anymore.
We had the same amount of heartache when a new round of indie kids exorcised the sorrow from all those soul-eating ghosts 8 years later. That was the year they blew up the high school. A heretofore unknown part of the exorcism ritual, I guess. And don't even get me started on when the indie kids fell in love with and then defeated all the vampires a few years back. Hannah's older brother Timu got mixed up with them and pretty much vanished one day. They haven't seen him since, though he writes the occasional email. Always at night. And we dream the same in my town as you probably do in a city. We yearn the same, wish the same. We're just as screwed up and brave and false and loyal and wrong and right as anyone else. And even if there's no one in my family or my circle of friends who's going to be the chosen one or the beacon of peace or whatever the hell it's going to be the next time around, I reckon there are a lot more people like me than there are indie kids with unusual names and capital D destinies. Though I'm being mean here, they're often quite nice, the indie kids, just they've got a clan and they're sticking to it. Me, all I want to do is graduate and have a last summer with my friends and go away to college and more than kiss Hannah more than once and then get on with finding out about the rest of my life. Don't you? Did you get in trouble? Jared asks the next morning as we sit down in the back row of a calculus class that he's already got so much extra credit in, he could skip the final and still get an A. Just the weekly lecture on how keeping a united family front is more important than usual in an election year. Blah, blah, blah. I glance at him. You were mentioned. He grins. I bet. The school bell goes as the classroom door opens a last time, and Nathan comes in. Sorry, he says, flashing a smile at Ms. Johnson, the calculus teacher. She's this really smart, funny, older lesbian, so the smile totally shouldn't work on her. Somehow, it still does. I count out the four corners of my desk. 7 times. Dude, Jared whispers. It's just a guy. He's not the devil. Hannah likes him. She said he was pretty. He is. I stop counting. Well, he is, Jared shrugs, just calling the facts. Yeah, but why would you transfer into a new school 5 weeks before? The intercom system crackles.
Attention, students, I guess,
says our principal. He's French-Canadian, and no matter what he says, he always sounds like he's dying of boredom.
I have some troubling and sad news that some of you will have already seen on social media, no doubt. I am afraid that the body of one of our seniors, Finn Brinkman, was found this morning. There are, as yet, no leads to the cause of his death, but we urge all students to take extra care, to not travel alone, and to report anything suspicious to the authorities. Counseling is available in the office should you need it or something.
Calculus has fallen silent. I turn to Jared. I know he's thinking the same thing I'm thinking. We should tell someone, I say.
Yep, he says. Won't do any good.
No, it probably won't. Well, that was a waste of a morning, Mel says as we gather for lunch. We've taken senior privilege and all piled into my car to go to the Mexican fast food place around the hill next to the school, even though we're lucky to have gotten a lunch break at all. We'd all met in the office and told the vice principal, who, like all vice principals, is genetically Nazi, what we'd seen. He eventually called one cop, whose breath was as thick with booze as my father's is in the evening. That cop proceeded to not believe a word we said about seeing Finn running through the field, the glowing girl running after him, or the blue pillar of light that rose and then faded. He basically yelled at us for wasting his time. Okay, fine. So Finn's body wasn't found anywhere near there, but I just can't believe the things that people won't believe, or the things people won't even see. I was in the 9th grade when the vampires came, but even though people started dying, even though people disappeared and stayed gone,
even though you could point at one and say, "That's a vampire." Most people, most adults, still don't believe it ever happened. What happens to you when you get older? Do you just forget everything from before you turned 18? Do you make yourself forget? I mean, the cop was old enough to have been a teenager when the whole soul-eating ghost thing was happening, so did he just block it out of his mind? Did he talk himself into not believing it actually happened? Convince himself it was a virus? That the explosion at the old high school was a gas leak? Or is it that he thought that what happened to him was so original, so life-changing and harrowing and amazing, that there's no way he could ever imagine it happening to anyone else? It's not every adult, I know, but still. We see a guy the day he dies, and the half-drunk policeman in charge threatens to arrest us. Honestly, adults, how do they live in the world? Or maybe that is how they live in the world. "I told you we shouldn't bother," Henna says, sitting next to me thinking nothing of it. When Timu disappeared, the police did exactly nothing. Said he was old enough to make his own choices. "At least you still hear from him," Mel says gently. "Once in a while." Henna shakes her head like that doesn't help, which, of course, it doesn't. "I think it's why my mom and dad go on all these mission trips. Try to beat some of the darkness out of the world with their bare hands." She makes this sound both impressive and a sad, sad waste of time. There's also pity. They did lose their son. The Silvanoinens are as complicated as anyone else. More if you count trying to say their last name out loud. I touch all of the pointed ends of the tortilla bowl they've fried to put my taco stuff in. There are 12, just like on a clock, which is so pleasing, I only have to count it once. I glance over at Mel's plate. She's got some salad and some plain chicken, so that's fine. And I heard her order a Diet Coke, also good. She hates having people watch her eat, though, so I make a point to look away, as do Henna and Jared. "I just hope whatever it is gets finished by graduation," Jared says. "Weird about that dead kid, huh?" says a voice. Nathan standing there with a tray, and surprisingly, he looks genuinely spooked. "Hey," Henna says a little too brightly. "You want to join us?" Mel and Jared scoot up to make room, so now I'm sitting across from him. "Hooray." "I don't think we've really met," he says to me. "Nathan." "I know who you are," I say, but I do shake his hand. I'm not that rude. "This guy who died, though," he says, and his eyes are still slightly wide. "Did any of you know him?" "He was an indie kid," Mel says, "so not really." Nathan stares down at his enchilada for a second. Henna and Jared watch him openly. Mel takes the opportunity to eat more of her chicken. I study Nathan, too. I can't see what Henna likes at all. His hair's that stupid forward swoosh mess that looks like it's eating his brain. His clothes are a kind of non-committal faded blue. His eyes are dark enough to be black, and his earlobes, when he brushes his hair out of the way, are scarred from where he obviously once had sprocket earrings before having them sewn up again. Idiot. Moron. I hate you. "So you're from Tulsa?" Henna asks, and I start eating my lunch. "Yeah," Nathan says, smiling faintly. "Before that, Portland. Before that, Fort Knox, Kentucky." "Army, Dad?" Jared asks. "Army Mom," Nathan answers. "Dad stayed in Florida. 5 postings ago." "Must suck," I say, trying to keep any heat out of my voice. "Moving to a new school 5 weeks before graduation." He runs a hand through that mop of hair. "Little bit," he says, meaning a lot. "And a kid dies my first week." He glances around the table. "Not that that's in any way suspicious." He smiles. The others laugh. "But wow, though," he says more quietly. "I hope whatever it is this time isn't too bad." My phone buzzes, 2 seconds before Mel's does, too. We both look.
Bolts of fire! Bolts of fire! Bolts of fire! Coming to fair! I'll die if I can't go. Please convince Mom. Please, 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 please.
Love, Meredith.
That can't be right, I say, showing the others the text. Bolts of fire? At our crappy little county fair?
Yeah, Hannah says. I saw it online somewhere. They're coming for some little girl's cancer last wish or something.
Nathan's staring at us. You guys aren't fans or anything? All right, I say later that night, putting extra slices of cheesy toast on a plate for the really, really fat family at table two. He is pretty. And nice, Jared says, dumping sprigs of parsley on our waiting orders. And a little bit tragic. And new. I heap the plates up on my tray. Jared does the same for his section.
I don't stand a chance, do I?
You've got the same chance you've always had, my friend, he says, and disappears into his half of the restaurant. We work at Grillers, a steakhouse for cheap dates, the kind of place with all-you-can-eat shrimp, all-you-can-eat fries, and all-you-can-eat cheesy toast, which, to be fair, is really awesome cheesy toast. The restaurant's so old, it's still split down the middle from when one side was smoking and the other non. Now it's all non, but we still divide the table service that way. It's Tuesday. It's slow. Jared and I are covering the whole place. You know, he says when we meet back at the waitress station. Still called the waitress station, even though it's only us two waiters tonight. This thing with Hannah only really came up when she started dating Tony. And now she's going to Africa after graduation. And then Nathan comes into our lives to catch her eye when she's single, and you're still gathering your courage. He eats a French fry off a plate. Ever thought you only really like her because there's always something in the way of actually getting close to her?
I think that all the time.
Seven wants more raspberry lemonades,
Tina, our manager, says, looming into the waitress station. She sets down the 2 pots of coffee she's used on her refill run and takes a slice of cheesy toast off one of my plates.
I swear they put crack in these, she says, eating it.
I deliver my plates. I get 3 more raspberry lemonades for table 7. I bring enough extra cheesy toast into the restaurant to feed the entire population that has ever lived on this planet. Grillers is high volume, fast turnover, and even if the tips are cheap, there are a lot of them. It's a great job. It keeps gas in my car. It gets me out of the house. I work a lot of shifts with Jared. I'm lucky, too. Mel works the cash registers at a 24-hour drugstore fighting off meth heads who've lost track of what year it is. And Hannah makes coffee at a drive-in Java Shack that doesn't even have its own bathroom. It's a great job. I'm lucky. It's a great job. But do you have any idea how dirty restaurants are?
I start washing my hands early in the shift, and 5 hours later at the end, I'm washing them almost every 2 minutes, which by then doesn't feel like often enough after touching one of the sponges we use to wipe the crevices of the booths after we close. 135. Jared counts his money, sitting on the steps down from the storeroom. $136.72. He straightens all the bills into a neatish pile and shoves them into his polyester uniform pocket. Not bad for a Tuesday. He looks over to where I'm standing at the prep room sink. What about you?
117. Even, I say, rinsing off the soap. I leave the water running. I've washed my hands so many times tonight, 2 of the fingertip pads on my right hand have cracked and started bleeding. The skin from my fingers to my wrists itches and burns because I've washed every bit of natural oil out of it. I grip my hands into fists, bearing the pain. Then I squirt some more soap on them and start washing them again.
You guys are the lucky ones, Tina says.
She's in the closet-sized office they give to the managers. The door is open,
and she's basically sitting next to Jared, her cheek resting on her computer keyboard, volumes of blonde hair splayed out over the desk.
You're so young. You're so lucky and young.
You're only 28, Jared says.
I know, Tina moans.
Jared gives me a quizzical glance as I wash my hands again.
Tell your Uncle Jared what's wrong this time, Tina.
She shoots him a dirty look, her face still molded onto the keyboard. But she answers anyway.
I think Ronald's cheating on me.
With who?
Jared's a little too surprised.
Hey, Tina says. Ronald's an attractive guy.
She hesitates.
A little short, but...
Ronald, who stops by every Saturday afternoon for a free lunch, comes up to Tina's shoulders and Jared's belt. I'm only slightly exaggerating.
Is it revenge for your thing with Harvey the chef?
Jared asks. Tina sits up, a cluster of keyboard squares embossed on her cheek.
Probably.
I squeeze another blob of soap on my hands. I can feel my chest start to constrict, actual tears welling up in my eyes. I'm just burning with rage at myself. But I rinse off the soap and start again.
He'll come back, Jared says, standing. He always does. So do you.
He hasn't gone anywhere,
Tina says, locking the safe and picking up her purse.
That's kind of the problem. If he left, I'd at least be able to clean up the house a little before he came back.
She flicks off the light in the office.
You know, he actually once lost a whole frozen turkey, and not even in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm,
Jared says, his eyes on me.
You guys done?
Tina asks, locking the office door.
Almost,
I say, hoping she doesn't hear the crack in my voice. She doesn't.
Good, I'm going to go set the alarm, and then we're out of here.
She heads out into the main restaurant where the alarm pad is, disappearing past the walk-in freezer. In two steps, Jared is behind me, putting his bigger, longer, stronger arms around me to pin my own against my side. He turns it into a kind of imprisoning bear hug, lifting me up and away from the sink. He just holds me there for a second, a few inches off the ground, neither of us saying anything. His forehead's against the back of my head, and I can feel his breathing on my neck. I'm not exactly a small guy, but I'm thin and a bit wiry, while Jared is enormous, tall and broad, and just big, big, big. Thank God he's not a bully, or he'd terrorize the school.
Okay?
He asks quietly, after a minute.
Okay,
I whisper, swallowing the huge lump in my throat. He sets me down, and slowly, gently, in the way that he has, he lets me go. I don't move. He steps around me, turns off the tap, and hands me some paper towels. I wince as I grab them, leaving several drops of blood against the white. Tina yawns her way back to us. She scratches a spot on her scalp with one long fake fingernail.
I wonder what Harvey the chef is up to these days,
she says. Jared keeps looking over at me as he drives us home. He's got a ridiculously tiny and old car for such a big guy, but it's just him and his dad, and they aren't overflowing with money. They're happy, though. His dad's the nicest grown man I've ever met.
It really has gotten bad again, Jared says, a statement rather than a question, as we drive deeper into the dark woods toward our homes.
I know, I say. I've been getting stuck in these kind of loops lately, and it's getting harder and harder to get out of them.
Even when it's hurting you?
Even when I know it's stupid. In fact, knowing it's stupid, knowing that I've already washed my hands 100 goddamn times, actually makes it worse. Because knowing that, and doing it anyway, is like...
I don't finish. We drive in silence for a little longer.
Your fucking parents, man,
Jared whispers. He raises his voice.
If you ever need a place, Mikey, I don't care how mad they get or how it affects her stupid career.
Thanks,
I mean it.
I know.
He hits the steering wheel with his fists.
I feel kind of shy about how upset he is on my behalf. But that's Jared for you.
4 1/2 weeks, he says. Chapter the fourth, in which Satchel and Dylan sit in a coffee house with understated live music and discuss what Satchel's uncle told them. Dylan also tells her it's clear that second indie kid Finn has feelings for her. Satchel doesn't see that this is Dylan's way of saying that he has feelings for her too. Later, the messenger of the immortals makes a surprising offer to indie kid Kerouac.
B. Okay, look, I gotta get some stuff out of the way. I wish I didn't, but it's necessary. This doesn't define me or any of the people I love, okay? It's just life. And we've moved on. But you gotta know. So.
4 years ago, when I was 13 and she was still 14, my sister had a heart attack. It was caused by arrhythmia, which was caused by Mel starving herself to death. In the ambulance on the way to the hospital, she died. They were able to revive her, obviously, but the fact remains that for 3 or 4 minutes, she was gone. We'd lost her. She says she doesn't remember anything about it. No lights, no tunnels, no angels or old relatives or prickly-faced Labradors to help her with her journey to the other side. But weirdly, she doesn't remember the opposite either. She doesn't remember nothingness or emptiness or oblivion. Her memory stops before the heart attack and picks up again in the hospital.
"Don't you wish you could remember?" I once asked her.
She looked at me as if I'd suggested murdering a duckling.
"Absolutely not."
Where were we at this point as a family? Mom was in the Washington State Senate and was running for lieutenant governor. I'm going to guess that your knowledge of / interest in state and local politics is as non-existent as most people's, but it's enough to know that this was something she considered both extremely modest and a big, big deal. She'd planned it for almost 3 years, way more than the other candidates seemed to, and we'd been photographed a lot in the run-up to the primary to see if she'd be selected as her party's candidate. Because weren't we all perfect and adorable? Weren't the Mitchells exactly what the state needed? Look at us with our healthy and unthreateningly average smiles, our hair that spoke of middle-class prosperity but wasn't too much better than yours, the modern political husband, super supportive, and perhaps a bonus extra behind the scenes, the 2 older children with their polite attitudes and good grades, and beautiful little Meredith, precocious and funny as a later Disney heroine. Wouldn't Lieutenant Governor Alice Mitchell be your friend, as well as your humble public servant, while hanging around in case the governor died? The problem was that hardly anyone had heard of her. The campaign had no money, and polls had her at a steady but distant 4th in the primary. It wasn't my mom who told Mel she was looking a little fat in some of the press photos. It was her one-day-a-month campaign advisor, a chain-smoking beard called Malcolm. But Malcolm did say it, and my mom didn't fire him. Was that enough to make Mel stop eating? Maybe. But we were hardly a hotbed of mental health before then. We didn't have nearly as much money as it looked like we had, for one thing, because my dad was still paying back the thousands he embezzled from my Uncle Rick's car dealership, where he used to be top sales manager. My dad stole, under Rick's nose, all the money to buy the house we still live in. He should have been arrested. He should still be in jail. But Rick is my mother's brother, and this was even earlier in her career when she was trying to move up from the State House of Representatives to the State Senate. A scandal would have ended her political career. So she and my dad not only stayed married, but she somehow convinced Rick to keep it secret and, if you can believe this, actually let my dad stay employed there. No access to any accounts, of course, but still selling cars until he's paid back all the money plus interest, which will probably take him up to retirement. As I said, Uncle Rick doesn't come around much anymore. So pretty much every day back then, we were about an hour away from losing everything. Money, careers, house, a father, all the while pretending we were the highly functioning family of an up-and-coming politician. My dad drank every day. Always did, still does. My mom threw herself into politicking, and Mikey Mitchell, your humble narrator, was so tense I'd started to get trapped in compulsive loops for the first time. Counting and recounting, and recounting and recounting. The contents of my sixth grade arts cabinet. Driving our poor dog Martha crazy, pre-porcupine death, by walking her over the same length of road 4 dozen times because I couldn't seem to get it exactly right. Though I could never have told you what right was. I was sent to a psychiatrist called Dr. Luther and was put on medication. And this was all before my mom decided to up the stakes by running for a bigger job. So all I'm saying is that the ground was clearly fertile for craziness to grow. My sister just got stuck with one that was particularly shit. One that killed her. Killed my mom's campaign, too. Malcolm tried to keep the press to a minimum. And this was at the start of the vampire romances, so there were plenty of mysterious deaths among the indie kids to be writing about anyway. But enough got out that my mother was forced to withdraw to support her daughter through a crisis that could hit any family. We all started this thing called FBT, family-based treatment, where we were supposed to show ourselves as resources for Mel instead of the cause of the problem. And for a time, we did. Mom set up a gradual eating routine that Mel eventually accepted. Me and Meredith were instructed on how to refer to food and Mel's condition in non-judgmental terms, which we were happy to do. We were so freaked out by maybe losing her, we would have burned all our clothes in a bonfire if it would have helped. Dad drank a bit less. And Mel got better. She gained some weight, not a lot, but an amount that made her healthy again. It took a while, over a year, which is why we're both seniors now instead of her already graduating. But she braved it out, and nobody gave her much shit when she went back to school. That's when she and Henna got so close, now that we were all in the same year. Meanwhile, my mom went back to the state senate. Someone else won the primary for lieutenant governor, and was subsequently slaughtered in the general election by the incumbent. So my mom started calling it a blessing in disguise, with a hard, far away look in her eye. I finished my own counseling with Dr. Luther. I stopped the anxiety medication. Things got kind of back to normal again. And that, I think, was the problem. They could absolutely deal with Mel getting so sick, but I don't think they could quite deal with her getting better. I did about 800 hours of anxious research on the internet and tried to tell them that almost 90% of anorexics do recover. But as time passed, they seemed to start resenting the healthy daughter just sitting there, the one that they'd sacrificed so much for, no longer needing the sacrifice. If she'd ever really needed it in the first place. She did. We could have lost her. I could have lost her. And then what? My mom started making vague references to missed opportunities and stopped coming to FBT sessions because she was doing important work down in Olympia, the capital. She handed control of Mel's diet over to Mel 4 full months before the schedule suggested. Mel asked if I would help her, and I have, every day since. We went back to barely seeing my dad. He's either in his office at work or his office at home. Usually smelling of alcohol, often asleep. To be fair, as alcoholics go, he's pretty low maintenance. He gets to work most of the time, he's never violent or scary, and he lets my mom do most of the driving. I think my mom keeps him out of trouble, mostly by being clear about what she would do if he were ever in trouble. So here we are now. I make sure my sister eats, she helps me out of my tics and loops, and we both watch over Meredith and try to stay out of our parents' way. But this, all this,
isn't the story I'm trying to tell. This is all past. This is the part of your life where it gets taken over by other people's stories, and there's nothing you can do about it except hold on tight